Welcome to Season 6 of Ye Olde Dragons Library, the Storytelling Podcast. Each episode this season will be a chapter from The Blue Lotus Society, a book in the Guardians of the Time Stream Gaslamp series. You might have met our heroine in the first book in the series, Odessa Fremont. S has been working as a Pinkerton agent for several years now. Her assignment, to guard a traveling Egyptian museum exhibition, puts her squarely between two powerful organizations, both of whom will stop at nothing to have the treasures and power hidden inside the artifacts. If she survives, her life will never be the same. Ready to find out what happens next? Let's begin. Chapter 3. S woke slowly, troubled by the sensation of being watched. It clashed with the stillness in the air that told her she was alone in a small, enclosed place. The last time she woke up with that prickling along her skin when someone focused all his attention on her, she had been in the Watertown jail, and Horace had been on the other side of the bars. No Horace sat on the other side of the walls surrounding her now. S lay on her back, limbs neatly arranged on a real mattress. She twitched the fingers of the hand pressed between her hip and the wall, vibrating with the hum of machinery, and cautiously stroked the cloth she lay on. Fine cotton sheet and wool blanket. They smelled of chamomile soap. S took a deep breath and flinched, feeling an ache around her ribs. Right where that black cable had wrapped around her, just before the man shot her with that odd gun full of sparks. Another deep breath, more ache, but she couldn't help it as all her memories snapped back into place in her mind. She had been in the rafters of the warehouse, above a stone-paved floor. Logic said the man had caught her in his cable before he shot her, to keep her from hitting the floor. From the ache, she had fallen far enough to be bruised from the sudden stop. "No thanks for small favors," she whispered. The sound of her voice bouncing back at her in the enclosed space told her more details. She lay in a bunk, with either the ceiling of the cell or the top bunk a few feet above her. A snail-slow shifting of her other arm revealed open space beyond the bunk, a room of some kind. That steady, almost subliminal humming in the thin wood of the wall told her she was most likely in the airship that had disgorged the automatons and the dark-dressed men on those cables. The engines of trains and steamships had different patterns and rhythms. Trains rumbled over uneven tracks, and steamships had to contend with waves, no matter how calm the day. S had never been in an airship, but other Pinkertons had told her about traveling in them, so she could guess at the smoothness of flight, except when storms churned the air in the heights. So, if she was in the airship, the next question was why these people who invaded the warehouse had brought her here. Why hadn't they just left her on the floor, like with Charles? Thanks for not letting her crash to the stone pavement to die in a shattered heap, by the way. Was he here on this airship, too? And if so, why hadn't their captors imprisoned them together? Unless they brought her up here alone? Logic said they wanted to find out why the gas knocked out Charles, but not her. S wanted to know what those sparks were in the Zeus gun. She could guess the sparks were lightning, just as Zeus was the Greek god of lightning. Such a weapon would make her job much easier and safer. There had been no sound when the man shot her. At least, no sound she heard. Much nicer and tidier than a gun with a loud bang and stink of gunpowder. She imagined how much safer her prowling jobs for the Pinkertons would be if she could silently knock her enemies unconscious and go on her way, rather than hiding in cramped places, sometimes even on top of wardrobes or the rafters of buildings or filthy alleys, for hours at a time until they went away and she could sneak out. Other than the bruises around her ribs and the dryness in her mouth, she felt fine. When her captors knew she was awake, they would question her, and she could try to get information from them. Would they be the kindly or foolishly arrogant kind of people whom she could talk into giving her some freedom or information that would let her plan her escape? Or would they be the intelligent, suspicious, cautious kind who wouldn't leave her alone for a moment and tell her nothing? That brought her back to the theory that they wanted to find out why she hadn't been vulnerable to the two gases. S fought down a shudder, remembering when she was 8 and wandered into her grandmother's laboratory without permission to see her dimpled, smiling granny performing a vivisection on a rat that had been subjected to various jolts of electricity and yet refused to die. Her grandmother hadn't been smiling, hadn't seemed to particularly enjoy tormenting the rat that struggled against the restraints, but it hadn't bothered her either. What sort of tests could or would these people perform to find out why she was immune? Better get it over with, she thought. The longer it takes, the farther we could be from Washington. It's a given I won't make the opening gala for the exhibition. At least Horace wouldn't know she had failed this assignment. He had died last January after rescuing his granddaughter who had fallen through rotten ice. Taking another deep breath, S. opened her eyes and rolled onto her side, putting her back to the wall. A dimly lit room with a copper basin bolted to the wall, a matching covered pitcher sitting in a rack next to it, floor-to-ceiling cabinet doors on the wall parallel with her bunk, and what looked like a hemp mat on the floor. She lay in the bottom bunk of two. Her boots sat on the deep bench underneath the basin and pitcher arrangement, on the short wall of the room. The opposite short wall was the door. Efficient sleeping quarters, but claustrophobic. Where did the light come from? S lay still, looking around with as little movement as possible, trying to discern the source. It seemed slightly stronger coming from overhead, but the bunk above her obstructed her view. She couldn't smell wax or kerosene or lantern oil. All she could smell was herself, the dust and grime of the warehouse rafters ground into her clothes, along with the sweet-sour smell of her own fear sweated into her clothes. At least her captors had left her fully dressed, except for removing her boots. A smile quirked up one corner of her mouth, as she tried to figure out why they had done that. Perhaps searching the soles for a knife blade or lockpick? Or maybe a foolish idea of keeping her from running? Although, why leave her boots here, if that was the reason? Very little could stop her fleeing if she needed or wanted to. Once she had figured out the Zeus gun and how to either keep it from firing or dodge that shaft of lightning, there would be one less deterrent on that list. She sat up, and immediately scrabbled for her cap, which fell off the back of her head when she levered herself upright. S snatched at it, and felt her long hair falling free down her back in two thick braids, all the pins holding her braids in place and her cap firmly attached to her head. Gone. Whoever had put her in this bunk knew she was female. That sensation of being watched flooded over her again, and it took all her self-control not to cross one arm over her chest and the other over her lap. She was decently dressed and covered, and as far as she could tell, the bands binding her breast flat were still firmly and tightly in place, and the briefs that changed her stride. No one had undressed her, but now that she had moved, she could tell they had taken away her derringer. They had searched her clothes enough to find it, but no more. Why? They knew her secret, which was more than anyone had guessed the last time she was a prisoner. Back then, she had the staff of the fanciest hotel in Watertown convinced she was a ragged orphan boy when she worked on a team of boys that kept the water tank filled. S had had no one on her side, and all the evidence stacked against her that day. She had been caught red-handed in a rich old lady's room, the stolen jewelry still in her hands. The problem was that S had been putting it back, having picked the pockets of the thieves she had seen coming out of that same window not half an hour before. Her predicament back then was similar to the one she faced now. Caught, the odds stacked against her, and no one on her side. But back then, she had Horace. He had come to Watertown to study the place and prepare for his team of Pinkertons setting a trap for a group of train robbers. He had spotted the burglars hiding in the shadows, climbing in and out of hotel room windows in broad daylight. He watched S, disguised as a boy, pick the pockets of the thieves and put the stolen items back. After all, her grandparents had taught her that God gave people their skills and abilities to be used. If she had the perceptiveness to see evil being done and the talent to right wrongs, she had a duty to God and her fellow man to do what she could. S was caught in the hotel room of the rich old woman who had been robbed, who just happened to be the hotel manager's aunt. She had gone to sleep that night in a jail cell, praying hard for some idea of how to get out of there before anyone realized she was a girl. That was more important than being put on trial for a crime she hadn't committed. Horace had spent that night proving Essa's innocence. It helped that the manager already knew who the real burglars were and was grateful for the return of his aunt's jewels. Horace's credentials as a Pinkerton agent had done the rest of the work, persuading the sheriff to let him set a trap for the two burglars. Horace had searched the corner of the stable loft where S slept and gathered up her few possessions while she was locked up. He had read her journal before she woke up and offered her a hot bath, a hot breakfast, and a job. S now looked around her efficient, neat prison room and felt sure no one was going to tell her this time around that she had been doing a good, honorable thing and had proven herself worthy of joining them. Her captors had been searching the Egyptian artifacts and took some things from those crates S had been assigned to protect. Logic declared them on the opposite side of the issue, no matter how the facts were twisted around. "I think I hate Egypt," she muttered, and gazed up at the ceiling. Anything to do with Egypt. The light came from the intersection of walls and ceiling. Soft, golden, rosy light spilled from the seams, spreading across the ceiling that looked semi-transparent and trickling down the walls. They weren't of the same material as the ceiling, S was glad to note, although that would explain the continuing sensation of being watched. Her captors could see her through the ceiling and walls. That meant she wouldn't be changing her clothes or stripping down to wash any time soon. If she couldn't turn off that light, she wouldn't be able to find sanctuary in darkness. Where did that light come from, and how was it fueled? Yes, she had seen incredible demonstrations of attempts to create light from electricity, but electric light was always harsh, as sharp and stinging in some instances as the electricity that fed it. This was soft, warm, like honey and flowers. Airships didn't have such conveniences. Airships, according to her fellow agents who had searched or traveled on such things for the sake of speed, were lit by oil lanterns, inside cleverly constructed gyroscopes and wire-reinforced glass cages to keep the oil from spilling and starting fires. Freight airships were built of light, tough metal struts and canvas stiffened with fire-resistant glue to provide as much cargo space as possible with as little weight as possible. Only the most wealthy, elegant passenger airships had metal walls and wooden doors, like her prison room. The heavier the vessel, the more steam and fuel required to keep it airborne and moving forward. So, her captors were wealthy and powerful. Powerful enough to take whatever they wanted, served by automatons that her grandmother had only dreamed of in those long-ago days of blissful innocence and wonder. What did they want with her? If they knew she was a girl, were they slavers, taking advantage of having her in their power, and plotting even now to break her will and sell her to some exotic foreigner for nefarious ends? S had read some of the reports that Pinkerton agents along the frontier sent in. Tales of women kidnapped by Indian tribes or Spaniards, or even the Orientals along the western coast. Usually, such women had blue eyes and blonde hair, taken specifically for their coloring that was so exotic in other lands. With her moss-colored eyes and dark hair, she wasn't exotic in the least. That didn't discount the theory of slavery. She had run away from the boarding school where her grandparents left her, just because those people intended to mold her into a delicate flower, intended for a politically or socially astute marriage. Another form of slavery, and more insidious than simply being sold as a concubine or sexual toy, because it required the numbing of her mind and soul. S would escape this place, too. She was sure of it, even if she hadn't the faintest idea right that moment how she would accomplish it. First step was to put her boots back on. The door clicked open the moment she finished tying her laces and took her foot down from the bench where she had rested it. She had few options, so she sat down again on the edge of the bunk and waited. A woman with large dark eyes and a sharp-boned face, framed in a coronet of dark braids, paused in the open doorway. After a few seconds of study, S felt sure she was the same woman who had appeared out of the darkness to distract her so the man could come up behind her with the Zeus gun. She wore a man's leather vest with extra pockets down the front, pristine white shirt, and long, loose blue trousers, and carried a book bound in dark red leather, open in her hands. The book had writing in red ink on the left-hand page, while the right-hand page was blank. The woman looked S up and down for several seconds, and a soft smile grew as the moment of silence extended. "I am Athena Latimer. As for who you are, well, we shall certainly prove it soon. Are you hungry? Or have you read too many penny dreadfuls, so you're certain we'll drug you?" S read challenge and humor in her eyes and voice. "Haven't you already proved," she emphasized that word, since Athena had used it, "that I'm immune to your concoctions? Wouldn't it be a waste to try to drug me again?" "Most certainly," Athena said. "But just because such an action is wasteful doesn't mean it is illogical, or that people who take such steps are illogical. What would you like to eat?" "Bread and butter." S fought the urge to press a hand against her belly. The mention of hunger and eating revived the nausea that had dug spurs into her belly after the second banana-smelling gas hit her. "Tea, heavy on milk and honey. Please," she added, hearing an echo of her grandmother's admonition that everyone deserved to be treated politely, no matter who or what they were. Choices that are soft on the stomach. That's a telling reaction. She pulled a short pencil from behind her ear, where it had been hidden in the soft abundance of her dark hair, and made a notation on the blank page. "Is all that about me? About what happened last night?" S amended, stunned at what she had blurted without thinking. "This is a daybook, noting everything that has transpired on this mission so far." Athena nodded. "Although I must admit, you have filled up quite a handful of pages since we bumped into you." "Tonight," she added, "only 4 hours ago." She gestured at the picture, then at the closest cabinet door as she spoke. "There are fresh clothes as well as linens and soap powder, so you can freshen up as you feel led. Having been awakened in strange surroundings one time too many, I told them to leave you be. Better to be a little filthy than to wonder what was done to you while you slept." "What was done to me, besides taking off my hat and shoes?" "And your gun? And proving your femininity?" That smile grew again, turning just crooked enough it hinted at slyness, but with such warmth sparkling in her dark eyes, it was impossible for S to decide if the woman was playing cat and mouse with her, or inviting her to enjoy a joke that she didn't quite comprehend yet. "How are you watching me?" she said, to keep from blurting a dozen questions jammed up at the base of her tongue. "Ah, interesting. We weren't exactly watching you, not visually. The same sensor mechanisms that allow the Mobys to surround you in the warehouse allowed us to monitor you. Your modesty is quite safe, if that is what concerns you. No peepholes or sliding panels or one-way transparent panels in the Golden Nile. That is the name of our valiant airship." Athena patted the door frame next to her. "I'm sure with time, with enough adventures, she shall take on a personality of her own, like other ships of renown. Perhaps, if all works out well, you shall come to love her as we do." "That sounds like you plan on me staying here a long time," S said. "I have a job. I have work to do."
We hope you enjoyed today's chapter. For more information on all the books and series featured in this podcast, or to purchase the ebook or audiobook for future reading and listening pleasure, please visit yeolddragonbooks.com. You can also find more information about our books and purchase ebooks on our Patreon page, Ye Old Dragons Library. Please consider supporting the podcast to gain access to free stories or discounts, or a chance to purchase a new book in advance of release. Thanks for listening to this episode of Ye Old Dragons Library.